Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been a particularly bumpy couple weeks at our nation's capital. The House of Representatives is still without a speaker, more than 2 weeks after California Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy was voted out of the speakership. That marks the first time in history that a House speaker has been removed in this way. The GOP's current nominee, Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, failed to secure the required number of votes in the first two rounds of elections. And to show you just how unpredictable and how quickly things can change, less than an hour ago, The Washington Post reported that Representative Jordan will not seek a third vote for the speakership. So what happens now? And where do California's Republican House members stand in what has been and continues to be a historic time? To catch up on everything that's going on at the Capitol, including the Senate, we welcome Shira Stein, the Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning, Shira.
Good morning.
Thanks. First question I'm thinking about, how has the week been in D.C. so far?
Oh, goodness. I mean, it's never calm in D.C. when you report on California politics, but the last couple of weeks have been especially nuts. The way it works, you know, with these speaker votes, is it's sort of a last minute call and you don't really know exactly when they're going to come. And then everybody rushes to the gallery so they can watch the votes. And then you sit there for probably 2 hours as every single member has to stand up and say who they're going to vote for. So it's just been really, really strange. It feels like Groundhog Day because of January when we did this for like four days in a row. So it's been a very weird time in Washington.
Yeah, it wasn't easy for Representative McCarthy either for him to get the House speakership. That's a good reminder. You know, so obviously you have to stay on your toes. But I mean, in line with that, less than an hour ago, Representative Jordan, the GOP current nominee, he reportedly said that he's not going to seek a third vote. Was this surprising to you? Do you know more about this?
So it sounds like from other reporting that he's not going to seek a third vote today, but he didn't say necessarily if he was going to seek another vote in the future. But it looks like he is going to back. There's been this discussion about whether or not you could empower the temporary speaker, who is Representative Patrick McHenry from North Carolina. He was put in this temporary speakership by Kevin McCarthy. Some Republicans are still saying that they oppose this plan, but it seems like Democrats are open to it, which will be interesting to see how that vote goes. But basically, there's debate about whether or not he has power to do certain things like call a vote on a resolution in support of Israel, for example, or fund the government like they need to do in the next month. So I think like everything on Capitol Hill, but especially right now, it's all really unpredictable and changes minute by minute.
When it comes to California, where have Republican representatives stood during this time?
Yeah, so with the exception of one person, the California Republicans have largely stood unified and have been voting for Jordan. The only person who did not was on the first ballot, Representative Doug LaMalfa from Northern California. He voted for Speaker Emerita. Former Speaker Kevin McCarthy on the first ballot. And he basically said that this was a messaging thing, that he was unhappy with the way McCarthy was ousted, but that he would vote for Jordan on the second ballot, and he did. So thus far, they're staying pretty unified. Even Kevin McCarthy voted for Jim Jordan, and on that very first vote, when he did, everybody applauded on the Republican side, which I was like, this is a weird scenario to be watching.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine there's like these nuanced, unusual, quirky moments that happen that don't really make it in the paper or in the news. Is there any that you can share with us?
Oh my gosh, my favorite one is they were doing their vote and they were going down the list of names, and around the E's in the alphabet, we were sort of starting to get the sense that Jordan was not going to get elected on the first vote, which I think most folks were expecting here in D.C. But then they get to Representative Jake Elzey from Texas, and he stands up and says that he's voting for Garcia. Now, Garcia is a common last name. There are numerous Garcias in Congress, but my immediate thinking was, I think there's only one Republican Garcia, And that is Representative Mike Garcia from California, from Santa Clarita area. And in fact, that's who he was voting for. And I was like, why is this one person voting for a random, like, lesser known California Republican? It turns out it's because Representative Elzey was, and this is the literal title, he was the wingman to Mike Garcia in the Navy. They served together. So that was just one of the many funny moments that we get on these sorts of days where members are just sort of sitting on the floor bored for many, many hours.
Yeah, that reminds me of when, you know, you can always write in a candidate when you vote. Like, I mean, yes. he basically did that.
Yeah, and there were some, like, other folks who did, like, a number of New York Republicans voted for Lee Zeldin, who had a failed run at governor of New York. So that was, like, a couple of them. This was just sort of so far out of left field that I don't think, like, even Garcia turned back at Elzey and sort of gave him a, like, WTF look when he voted for him.
Yeah, the timing of this, too. I mean, it can't be underscored enough. You know, we do have an election. Primaries are coming up in, like, 5 months, at least for California. Obviously, the general next November. So given, at least optically, there's a lot of dysfunction going on within the Republican Party, how could this shape these really pivotal swing districts in the upcoming election? I mean, I think of districts in California who voted Democrat back in 2020 in the presidential election, but then in the midterm, they were able to flip it and elect a Republican to the House. What impact could this have?
Yeah, there's definitely a couple of Republican seats in California that the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party, is targeting because they think that they have a good shot of flipping those and thereby flipping the House. I mean, this is going to be really tough for them. Look, like, one of the biggest things that a speaker does is they fundraise to keep their members in office. And so that was Kevin McCarthy's job, and he was really good at it. Not as good as former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but also very, very good at it. He has said, now that he's no longer speaker, he's going to continue fundraising for those California Republicans. They're a very tight-knit group. So they still will have that backing. But Jim Jordan, for example, he is not known as the greatest fundraiser. So I think there's probably a lot of concern from California Republicans right now of whether or not they'll be able to keep their seats. Also, Jordan is, I think someone consider him to be further right than Kevin McCarthy. And that could lead to voters saying, oh, why are we going to elect a Republican, when that could lead to Republicans being in power and this guy who we think is too far right? And I know that's the case that some Democrats are already planning on making, is that, you know, a vote for, say, Representative Duarte is a vote for Jim Jordan as speaker.
Yeah, I mean, could be easy to paint a party with a wide brushstroke, whether Republican, Democrat, or third party. But, you know, there is diversity in thought and views within each party. When it comes to California and the Republican members in our state, how would you characterize them as a group compared to Republican Congress members elsewhere?
Yeah, I think they pretty much all stick with kind of whatever the party line is. You know, when somebody covers Republicans on the Hill, there's always the people, the firebrands. I'm thinking of, like, Matt Gaetz, used to be Jim Jordan, folks who kind of stood out and would say things differently from the rest of their party. But the California Republicans tend to be pretty along the party line and pretty unified. So, you know, they all were 100% for Kevin McCarthy earlier this year. They're now all 100% for Jim Jordan. Well, as long as he is the candidate, it seems like. So I think they're not a monolith, but they do, I think, tend to talk and sort of come to an agreement. I know California Democrats, also not a monolith, but they have regular weekly lunches and they all talk together. So California is kind of a unique state in that way. I don't know if many other state delegations that do that.
Given that this is such uncharted territory, I just know that there's obviously questions that can't be answered, but it does remind me of former House Speaker and also California, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, she had to fight for the speakership more than once. Has she commented publicly on what's happening?
She's made a couple comments about their inability to do math. She made these comments kind of earlier this year when Kevin McCarthy couldn't get the votes. But she's sort of known as, like, she would never bring anything to the House for that she didn't know she had the votes for. And so she's made a lot of comments about the lack of ability of Republicans to do the same thing, to know where their members stand and what they're going to do on the floor.
I would imagine Democrats as a whole in the House, are they pleased at what's happening right now?
I don't know that I would say they are pleased, because they're all very unhappy with the fact that they can't do anything except for sit and vote for Speaker, because obviously there is a war breaking out in the Middle East right now. There is funding that they need to do. There are so many things that they just cannot do because they don't have a permanent speaker. I know that they're definitely capitalizing on the politics of it and plan to use that for the elections next year. But I think they're all just frustrated with the fact that this is still ongoing. I mean, I think I saw today, this is day 16 without a speaker. I mean, things are always unprecedented in Washington, but this is like, this is a whole other level of not being able to do anything, because most of the time you need both chambers of Congress to get something done.
Yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Shira Stein, the Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle, about the ongoing House Speaker elections and other business on Capitol Hill. So let's turn quickly or briefly to the Senate. How has the newly appointed Senator LaFonza Butler, how's she been settling in?
Well, unfortunately, she's missing what would have been her first full week in office because she is out with COVID right now, which it still spreads like wildfire here on Capitol Hill because nobody masks. So, yeah, she's out with COVID this week. There was an announcement made about which committee she'll be sat on. Committee assignments can have a really big impact on what a lawmaker can get done, what sort of issues they take the lead on. And one of the committees she'll be sat on is judiciary. She will be taking the seat of the late Senator Feinstein on this super critical space for Democrats. So I think that's going to be that's something that I wasn't necessarily expecting, because it's a pretty senior position, and I expected it to go to a more senior member. But I think that's a pretty big deal, and she'll be sitting on a couple of other committees. And so I think it'll be really interesting. This is also the first time we're not going to have a California on the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, because neither she nor Senator Padilla are on it. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of money California gets in the next appropriations bill.
You did report recently on Senator Alex Padilla. He announced the formation of a new bipartisan mental health caucus. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, this is something that he and his staff have been working on launching for a couple of months. But as of 2 days ago when I spoke with him, there are 10 members, 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. And basically, this is the first time the Senate has ever had a group dedicated to focusing on mental health, which is sort of shocking to hear, but the Senate can move slowly. But I spoke with Senator Padilla. He has this really deep family history. His mother-in-law lives with bipolar 1 with schizoaffective disorder. And he sort of briefly mentioned that in passing in the past. But he and his wife spoke to me and really went in depth about, you know, what has their experience been helping her get care? What has their experience been getting care during the pandemic? You know, his wife talked about her going to therapy during the pandemic and their 3 sons going to therapy because the impact of the pandemic had on them. So it was a really interesting and important conversation to have, and I think we're seeing more and more of this. You know, that he was not the first, but Senator Fetterman's discussion about his depression, about getting inpatient treatment, has really sort of opened the floodgates for many more lawmakers on Capitol Hill and in the Senate to talk about their own experiences in greater detail.
What does he hope the caucus will accomplish?
Yeah, their first priority is there was a big law passed in 2022, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. A lot of people focus on it as a gun violence prevention bill, but it also had some really important mental health provisions. And so a big priority for them is sort of making sure that's implemented, making sure states and localities are get the funding and do the things that they need to do to make some of the changes from that legislation. He also said he really wants to look at workforce. You know, the comparison he made was after the Affordable Care Act was passed, many state legislatures took action to make sure there was enough healthcare workforce to actually meet the need and the folks who were newly getting insurance. And I think that, and he sort of alluded to, you know, that's what he wants to do here is make sure that there is the workforce now that folks are being more comfortable getting help and are more willing to get help. He wants to make sure that there is the provider there, that if you are looking to talk to a therapist, that you can actually find one on your insurance and at a cost you can afford.
Finally, Shira, I mean, as you touched upon, there's a lot of pressing issues that are essentially like put on hold, you know, as the House figures out how to move forward and what to do next. I mean, one of those is the government shutdown. Congress bypassed or averted a government shutdown not too long ago, but that threat returns in about a month. Given everything going on, what is your confidence level that it will be averted again?
I think that I'm more nervous than I've ever been about a government shutdown. You know, the last time seemed really, really bad. It was tight at the very end. They did it like the very last day they could, which is kind of typical for Congress. But right now they have to elect a new speaker, or at least according to the current rules, they need to elect a new speaker before they can even start considering bills. And the reason that Kevin McCarthy was ousted partially was attributable to the fact that he made this deal to fund the government. So I am really nervous that I don't know that they're going to be able to elect a speaker to make a deal, any of these things. I think it's going to be really messy. And it's the shutdown would happen just before Thanksgiving. So maybe they'll use that to kind of pressure themselves into making a deal so they can all get home for Thanksgiving. But it's going to be really close and a really tense few weeks in Washington.
Shira, thank you so much for keeping us in the loop.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Shira Stein is the Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Having an abortion is a personal and intimate experience that has been debated and argued over for decades. Often the loudest voices aren't those who navigated ending a pregnancy firsthand. Those voices have been drowned out largely by politics and the courts. Today, the choice to have an abortion can look drastically different from one state to another, following the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. And rightfully, there's a great deal of conversations from a legal, medical, and ethical standpoint about the impact that this historic decision has had and continues to have on reproductive rights. But at the heart of this are people that many of us personally know who have navigated abortion for their own reason and on their own terms. So we're going to focus on that today. Joining us are Andy Wilson and Lorraine Aller to share their unique stories. Andy and Lorraine are part of the CAP Radio's newest podcast, This Is What It Feels Like, which shares the voices of people often overlooked or politicized by society, with new episodes dropping on Thursdays. Welcome, Andy and Lorraine.
Thank you so much. Becky.
So this newest episode, which is now available on our website, This Is What It Feels Like, which is hosted by Tara Lopez, it focuses on having an abortion from a very personal lens. I'm curious, what inspired or motivated each of you to become part of this? Lorraine, I'll start with you.
So when I had my abortion, I was really, really young. I was 17. So it felt like something I couldn't talk about until I was a little bit older, when I was in my early 20s. And it made me realize, as Roe v. Wade was like, this was about to be overturned, I wanted other people to know that they weren't alone in their experience.
How about you, Andy?
So when I had my abortion, I felt like it was a very isolating and difficult experience, as somebody who also felt like I had a lot of privilege at that time. So I thought, if this was difficult for me, what is it like for other people? And I started to look into trigger bans that were already happening before Roe v. Wade was overturned. And that's really when I got passionate about trying to support and help other people.
You know, Andy, what aspects of abortion do you think people miss or get wrong? You know, because it's talked about so much, you know, in kind of like the noise of news. But, you know, a lot of people don't really have these really personal conversations with someone who's actually gone through this.
Yeah, that's a great question. Just how normal it is and how many people have them all the time and I think are scared to talk about it because it's so destigmatized, even like, or it is stigmatized, excuse me, just based on people who I think are, you know, anti-abortion all over the country. And that was a big reason why I was nervous to speak out when I went through it, just because my family, parts of my family are anti-abortion. And just like the louder we get and tell our stories, is going to normalize it for people who don't want to speak out.
Yeah. I'm going to play some clips from the podcast, which people can listen to today, anytime they want. And it starts with you, Lorraine, because there's a part of the podcast of this episode that you really give us a glimpse of the decision of whether to tell people, coupled with how others respond if you choose to be open. So let's just start off with the experience that you shared first.
So I had one instance after my abortion where I was in the kitchen and I think some of it ended up getting billed to my parents. And my dad very calmly asked me if I was pregnant and I said no, and then never brought it up again, which that's exactly what I needed at the time, was just like, okay, as long as you're good, we're good. It's totally, I'm not gonna pry. I pretty much tried my best to suppress the whole experience until I reached my early 20s. And then I started to realize people around me had had abortions, or I had friends who were in the process of getting an abortion. And that started to help me realize like, oh, like, this isn't something that's shameful. This is something that's normal. This is something that people need to do and know themselves well enough and understand their bodies well enough if that's something that they can handle at the moment.
Yeah, Lorraine, given that you were young at the time, you were 17 years old, but I love that clip because it shares like capturing how you evolved into adulthood. What did that teach you?
It really taught me that, like I said in the interview, I think people really truly know themselves well enough to know if it's the right time to have a child or if they want a child at all. I've even had friends who are parents and couldn't handle another kid who have had abortion. So like the stories are just, there's just so many different reasons why people do it. And I think it's up to them. And even though I was 17 and really young, I knew that it was not right for me, and it wouldn't have been right for the child either.
Andy, I mean, you also share the moment when you chose whether to open up to your roommates and also on the flip side, having to manage other people's feelings. So let's take a listen to that.
I told some people that night and, you know, everybody's hugging me and like, we support you. And then one person specifically asked like, so are you going to be a mom or like, you know, you're going to have a baby, like assuming like I wouldn't have an abortion for some reason. That was the first one that kind of put me off. I was like, oh no, I'm not, I don't think I'm planning on keeping it. One in particular was closer to the day I was having my abortion and a roommate was leaving for an international trip before Christmas. And she asked if she could touch my belly. Yeah. And that was really shocking to me because I didn't want any emotional connection. I didn't want to think of it as a fetus or a baby. It was an embryo to me. I did not want to think of it as a baby. So that was really upsetting. And I just had to tell her, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And that's not the way I think about this. And then she just left.
Yeah, Andy, I mean, like, you're choosing to be vulnerable and open with people. But, you know, I think what I learned from that experience is, you know, people can bring their own stuff into how they react to what you're sharing.
Yeah, exactly. And I expand on this a bit in the interview. I think it's just so important to listen to people's experiences. And I think everybody's experience is so different. And like, the reason why they're having an abortion or, just there's so many instances. I've had several friends like have miscarriages or medical complications as well. And that's not talked about enough. It's just, I think more people need to listen and just be supportive and ask what folks need who are having those abortions.
Given that this is such a unique experience from one person to the next, no story is the same. Do you have some advice for someone about kind of navigating that decision of who to tell, when to tell?
Yeah, I think just, you know, the people that you trust the most around you. I also had a lot of friends, even though it was a bit of an isolating experience at first, the more I talked about it, there were people who rallied around me. I was able to tell my sister, who was a big supporter. I'm very grateful for that. I think you know in your heart, like, who those people might be. And I do feel like there is way more education out there now since Roe v. Wade has been overturned, and hopefully more people are understanding and like ready to listen and have those conversations and support.
Lorraine, what advice, if any, do you have for someone who's kind of, you know, hinging on deciding whether to be open about this and sharing it with other people?
Similar to what Andy said, you know, I think you know the people you can trust deep inside, and the people who love you are going to support the decision.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about some firsthand experiences of navigating an abortion. And this is in collaboration with CAP Radio's new podcast, This Is What It Feels Like. So I want to get to support and how to offer it. And Andy, I want to start with you because you talk about and you explain how you wish you were supported by loved ones. So let's play a quick clip of that and then we'll talk about it after.
I just wish people would have asked me more of what I needed rather than focusing on the actual like, oh, like Andy is gonna like abort a baby, or like the way they saw it, I think, in their eyes. Or can I be there with you? Is there anything you need after your abortion? Like, the aftercare is just as important as during, in my opinion. If I know anybody going through that, I just mostly want to listen to their experience too. I think a lot of people just need to talk about their experience and find some kind of common ground with people, or at least that's like what I needed afterwards. And it's different for everyone. Pregnancy does not look the same across the board at all. But just kind of knowing like, oh, this is what taking the pills at home is probably going to look like, and the timing of everything, and these are the things you should have. I just think it's so important to share all the little details like that, so people feel loved and supported and cared for, and knowing like it's okay. And abortion is completely normal. And however you feel about it, if you're sad about it, if you regret it, if you're like, that was such an easy decision for me, it's everything is acceptable and, you know, completely valid.
You know, obviously, there's not a handbook for this, and resources can be really hard to find. And that also can apply to loved ones who know someone who's going through this. What advice do you have for someone who wants to offer support but through something like this, but wants to do it right and make sure that they don't do anything that creates unintended harm, Andy?
I love that question so much. There are so many local organizations like in every single state who have been doing this work for a long time, who often have resources listed on their websites, have social media. There's so much like reading you can do, and just like listening to stories like Lorraine and mine. Like, I do think it's just becoming more publicized. and also learning about the actual processes of having a medical or a procedural abortion. I think it's something that anybody can learn. Obviously, like, again, everybody's experience is different. There are things that can happen, and you can still be supportive in those moments, as, you know, if there are any complications. But like, especially with like medical abortions and seeing how easy it is to like get information on pills specifically, I think that's one thing that like everybody can do. And as I mentioned in the interview, like the aftercare, postpartum care in general, like for pregnancy, just because your hormones change and everything going on, just I think that's a really good place to start, is like checking out local abortion workers and organizations and listening to them.
Lorraine, I love a part that you share about just like the power of community and shared experiences. So let's take a listen and then we'll talk about it after.
If I had access to these stories, I don't think I would have felt as isolated or as alone or as like ashamed. I think there's all these myths around like who gets abortions and why. And I think the louder people are about their experiences, the more we can normalize it. I think it's much easier to have less empathy when you're talking about this general concept than it is to hear like one-on-one stories. Like, I'm sure if I sat down face-to-face with a lot of pro-life people and had an open dialogue with them, they would realize like I'm a human who made a really tough decision, that I'm not this hypothetical concept, that I'm not this like theory or large political debate, that I'm like a real person who had to make a really hard decision that was the best thing for myself in the long run.
And Lorraine, that's such a poignant realization, you know, just the power of being vulnerable and being open to share a personal experience, to kind of break down, you know, an issue that can be so stigmatized. I mean, when you reflect on how you were able to come to that realization, how were you able to come to that?
I think it started, so a few different things. My friends and I talking about it when we were in our 20s. And then also now I'm a nurse. And so when we do the maternity section, you learn a lot about like fetal abnormalities and just different reasons on why people have abortions. And that doesn't necessarily matter, but I feel like people think that some people are using it as an alternative to birth control, when really like people who want to have kids sometimes have to have abortions, and that's also really devastating. And then there are just some people who in the moment are not ready to have a kid.
Mm-hmm. Andy, yeah. How has your experience, you know, shaped your life and what you do in your life?
It has completely changed my life for the better. I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing right now. Like, I mean, I understand a lot of people have children and continue to do their jobs, but I feel like I'm just able to support other people in their decision making, whether it is pregnancy or abortion, and talk through those things. And it gives me so much joy, especially in this time where it's just getting more dangerous and scary by like the day. I've met so many incredible people doing this work that need to be amplified more, in my opinion. Yeah, I'm just so grateful to do my job. I work with specifically more musicians and artists right now. I've recently been working with Shout Your Abortion on campaigns and trying to get resources out on the road at merch tables, especially in the South, and just people speaking out and bringing more awareness about abortion in their communities.
And Lorraine, I imagine, you know, you mentioned you're a nurse, you know, this lived experience also shapes how you care for others.
I don't work in labor delivery or anything like that, but it's also given me a perspective of just, yeah, it really is up to the individual. And I have a lot of patients who don't have any family or anyone to care for them. And I don't know. It's just a personal decision and that shouldn't be involved in government.
Yeah. Finally, I'm wondering if both of you have already listened to the episode because it just became live not too long ago. And if you did, great. And if you didn't, just overall, like being part of this with other people in this episode, I'm just curious how you feel about it and what it adds to your own personal journeys of navigating this. Andy?
It was so beautiful to listen to. I cried last night. Just hearing everybody's stories, it's exactly how I see this movement, and knowing that all our stories are different and there's so many common themes just spread throughout them, and that we can all come together and like share this powerful message. I just love hearing everybody's stories and the way we're normalizing abortion and like saying the word, like it's so important. I'm very grateful to be a part of this.
How about you, Lorraine?
The episode was really beautiful to listen to. It also brought me a lot of closure, which was really interesting to just get my story out there. And yeah, I think these are really, really important and beautiful stories.
Well, Lorraine and Andy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Andy Wilson and Lorraine Allard are sharing their unique stories of navigating abortion. Andy and Lorraine are part of CAP Radio's new podcast, This Is What It Feels Like, which shares the voices of people who are often overlooked or politicized by society. New episodes drop on Thursday. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Support for Insight comes from University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law, offering a four-year part-time evening program for professionals working full-time in California's capital. Details at law.pacific.edu.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Mahsa Amini, just over a year ago, the 22-year-old woman was arrested by Iran's so-called morality police for improper dress, allegedly not wearing her hijab, a headscarf, in accordance with Iranian government standards. She was severely beaten and died while in custody. Her death sparked outrage around the world. Protests broke out in Iran, the largest in years. Many Iranian women even removed their hijabs and cut their hair in public as a sign of protest. Next week, a new exhibit will be revealed at the University Union Gallery on the campus of Sac State, and it's called The Seen Iranian Woman. It is inspired by the tragic events surrounding Mahsa Amini's death. The goal of the exhibit is to shed light on what it's been like to be an Iranian woman in recent years through art, poetry, history, and fashion. The exhibition is curated by Jaleh Noz, professor of fashion, merchandising, and management at Sac State. Jaleh is joined by Sac State's director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies, Sahar Rezavi. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Before we dive into this exhibit, which kicks off next week, Sahar, I want to start with you. If you can take us back to last September, you joined us on Insight following Mahsa Amini's death. Just remind us about what happened.
Sure. So as you said, she was a young woman, a Kurdish-Iranian woman visiting Tehran with her family. She was detained by, as you said, the so-called morality police or guidance patrol, depending on the translation. And she was beaten. She fell into a coma and she died a couple of days later. And when news of her death was leaked by some intrepid journalists. Outrage, as you said, broke out. The largest protests in years, the protests that posed the greatest challenge to the regime in many years, broke out, and also solidarity protests around the world. And those street demonstrations actually turned into more organized and coordinated actions, like labor strikes, student protests around universities. The government responded, as they usually do, with violence, with repression, with mass arrests. Almost 20,000 people were arrested. Over 500 people were killed. At least 9 were executed. There are still several on death row for charges related to the protests. And so at this point, there is still protest happening, but it has somewhat died down on the street, as, again, it often does in response to state brutality. But there are still actions going on. We just sort of hear about them less at this point.
Yeah, I was going to ask because, I mean, it was only a year ago. Is there still, in your view, an adequate amount of coverage about this?
You know, I think that given the importance of these protests for the Iranian political and social landscape, I would like there to be more coverage of this. I don't think that there is enough, in my personal view. I understand why it happens that way. I know how the news works. But one of the primary kind of central calls that we had from Iranians at the height of the street protests was they said, "Maro Tanha Nazarid, don't leave us alone here." And what that meant, it meant several different things. But for me, one of the most important calls to action for us was keep us highlighted, keep us spotlighted. Don't forget about what we're doing here. Don't leave us to our fate here by ourselves. It was a call for solidarity. It was a call for attention on what they were going through. And to the extent possible, I think it would be very important for the movement for there to be continued coverage of what they're doing.
In a piece of this, I mean, art is powerful. And Anjali, that brings me to you. When did you start thinking about putting together this exhibit?
Yeah, so thank you for having me on. I'm very grateful to be here and to have this talk about Iran. It was the 2022 protests when I was driving to campus to teach and just grasping for news, trying to connect. Being an immigrant living here, I moved here when I was 9. I just felt like that could have been me. It just felt very personal. It felt, but then at the same time, I felt very distant. I was living kind of a very detached life here. And I wanted to connect. So I wanted to have a space where people on campus were Iranians, where people could come together and dive deeper into what has been going on and what life has been like for Iranian women the last few decades. And just wanting that platform and that space is what motivated me to do the exhibit.
And you grew up in Iran.
Yeah, I was born in Iran. I lived there until I was 9. So I lived through the Iran-Iraq War and went to public schools. At 9, you dress in the school uniform where your hair is covered, long sleeves, long pants, all navy is what I wore. I remember a memory when I got in trouble for having nail polish on my fingers. I remember being stopped and having someone wipe their fingers on my eyelashes to make sure I didn't have mascara on. And so that was kind of my early experience in Iran. And then when we moved to America in 92, being a very lower socioeconomic family, fashion kind of just hits you in the face because it can be a tool for social change and a way to get attention, but it can also be an important tool to fit in and to conform, which is kind of all you want when you're in middle school in America at a young age. And, you know, and then later on, fashion turned into a means of survival for us. My mom started an alteration shop, and that's where I learned how to sew. And then I've continued on with designing, teaching at the university level, and just seeing how important of a tool fashion can be.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because fashion is so much more than just clothes, and you laid that out beautifully. Given that you have this experience of living in Iran and also living here, do you see parallels with when it comes to fashion and specifically women?
Yeah, this coming up with this exhibit, one of my goals was to create this platform to observe, learn, and dive deeper. But another one, I have three daughters, and it has been to show kids are so visual. So it's really been to help them visualize what fashion was like for women in the 50s, 60s, 70s in Iran, the freedoms that they had, and then how quickly that changed and those freedoms were pulled away. For my daughters, when they walk through this exhibit and any other kids, I want them to really see that and let it sink in of how the choices and the freedoms that they have today is not something that's guaranteed to them in the future, and that they really need to stay connected, stay involved, not become complacent, and to see this expression in fashion and to always demand equality.
Yeah. I mean, you sent some of the pieces, and I got to take a look at some of them. And, you know, obviously, like, art can, I mean, the best art makes you feel really profound things. And what I felt was kind of what you laid out. I mean, there are some beautiful pieces, but you also remember that there's adversity and there's pain, and fashion is can illustrate that. When you were curating this, putting this all together, that must have been an emotional journey for you.
It's been really emotional. It's been really emotional, and it's been extremely educational. Moving here at a young age, you kind of get consumed into like the need to fit in and belong, and you just want to fit into the American image. And then this experience has forced me to dig deep into my roots and have a lot of conversations with my parents. My mom's 80, my dad's almost 90. And on this topic, they were the experts, and it helped me understand, why was it that my grandma chose to wear a hijab? Why was it that my mom talks about her days wearing miniskirts in Iran? What has happened? And it's just been an extremely enlightening experience.
I love that, because it's not just taking in the exhibit, it's what happens after the exhibit, and it can be quite powerful.
Yeah.
Sahar, when you took it all in, or I would imagine you've seen a lot of these pieces, you know, how did it make you feel?
Well, for me, I'm already sort of immersed in the political and historical for in Iran, because that's my area of study. It's my area of specialization. And so for me to have an opportunity to look at the art side was very profound. It was it hit me in a whole different kind of sense, because academics tend, especially in my field, we tend to get kind of cerebral about these issues. And for me, it's very personal because of my family, because of the family history, the connections, my family's experiences before and during the Iranian Revolution and after. There's a whole kind of complex family history for me as well. So I really appreciated the opportunity to become involved in a side of it that I don't often have a chance to become involved in. And I was really, I am very grateful to Jala for inviting me to be involved in this.
Yeah. You know, Jala, I want to also touch upon, I mean, you have this other personal art piece that's taking shape and evolving at Sacramento State with the beautiful trees on campus. Can you talk to us about that? You sent some images of it, and they're just beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the pieces actually that I plan on including is a dress I made in honor of Neda Aga Sultan, who was killed in the 2009 protests. The other one is, you know, kind of the days after the 22 last year's protests, I was just kind of lost in the environment of walking to work. I just felt very lost. And so what I was noticing was the leaves that were falling off the trees, oftentimes very quietly, but they're beautiful. And some of them, it looked like they weren't dried up yet, and they were just falling. And so I just naturally started grabbing them. And then over the last year, I've collected them. My kids collect them. We've pressed them. And I've come up with an idea of writing down the names of the extremely brave women, the people who've lost their lives in fighting for equality and freedom, on these leaves. And for me, that has been a way to mourn their loss one by one, to see them, to remember them, but then also to demonstrate how many lives are quietly falling before their time, and how tragic all this is. And so that's kind of my fashion designer make it work because it's not done yet piece that I hope to add in.
Zoe and Sahar, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for talking about this.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to the exhibit. Jalé Nos is a professor of fashion merchandising and management at Sacramento State. Sahar Razavi is the director of Sacramento State's Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies. The scene, Iranian Woman, is at Sacramento State, and it opens next week. We have more information on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.